on this Chinook program, Hunting the Bowhead Whale.
It's big and it's black, and probably the head is half the body.
Whale specialist Ray Cronenberg.
It eats by filtering its food through a baleen. It weighs about a ton a foot. It's covered by about 12 inches of fatty substance called muktuk. Then there's meat underneath that and the rest of the skeletal structure that makes up an animal. The biology of the whale is such that we know that it has an eye similar to a horse, a stomach similar to a cow. It's pretty normal, but it's a really pretty animal, and it's just beautiful to watch it swim.
You see a whale, what would you do? Whaling Captain Tom Brower Sr.
Well, in the spring whaling, the custom of the native people was to wait for the whale, to keep quiet. That's where their teaching is, that's to be as quiet as possible when you're on that edge of the ice, because that's where the whales coming, migrating northward, are going to be following that lead, and they're playing on the edge of it.
1976, September 27th at 10:30, I shot a whale. 10 minutes later, it was dead.
James Nauriak.
I never shot a whale shoulder gun before. I knew how to pull the trigger, aim the thing at the whale, and knew some anatomy. I think I have listened to my dad talk about how the whale is shaped and where the vital parts are. And when they are butchering the whale, I'm there looking, where's the heart, where in the intestines, where's the liver, where's the joint, neck joint, where's the brain, where's the eye, and all of these things that through observation over the years prepared me, I guess, to look at the whale when I'm right up to it. This is where I'm going to hit it. It happens maybe 1 second, and that's all you need. Okay, that's all you'll have time when you're on a boat. You're aiming at that whale. The computer in your brain just clicks just 1 second, and shoot. And that's what I'm hoping to do when I get on that, when I lift that harpoon, I look at the whale, I look at the angle of the harpoon and the angle of the darting gun. There are two different angles there, so I have to make adjustments for that angle of the harpoon, because the harpoon goes in first, and then the darting gun trigger is triggered, and the darting gun will go in a different direction. You have maybe 1-2 seconds when you're up on that whale.
About 20 whaling crews camp out on the shore fast ice during the time of the whale migration, usually late April and early May. There are white canvas tents for sleeping and shelter from the wind, a Coleman stove inside for making tea and coffee, and outside there are windbreaks of ice blocks to sit by while looking for whales. An umiak, a skin-covered boat, is near the water's edge, the crew's equipment inside. If a whale is sighted, the crew must quietly slip into the boat to pursue the giant mammal. Some of the crew members have special jobs, as Barta Soriak describes while standing in the wind at his camp.
Well, the guy at the front, the harpooner, got to be the head man. Shoulder gun, it depends who's more experienced. And the guy at the rear is supposed to be one of the experienced ones. The guys in the middle are. They're trying to take the place of somebody up front in case nobody's there to show up. The guy on the right takes care of the float, throws it up, and the harpooner throws his dart, his harpoon. Gonna be quiet. One spook and spoils your whole day.
Learning to be a good whaler, a valued crew member, takes time. There's the inevitable process of trial and error, of earning a place in the boat. The apprentice whalers, the rookies, are given the job of taking care of the others. James Mumialuk Nagyak has been a whaling captain for the past 2 years. His father was a captain before him. To earn the right to be a whaler, James first went out to camp when he was 17.
One of the things that a rookie has to do is just the dirty work, you know, wash dishes. And in those days we had wood stoves, or not tents. Not so much wood, but we used blubber to heat the tent. And so we kept the pots boiling and make sure that the coffee is strong and the tea is strong. Comments that sometimes I'm revealed to believe you make the tea too weak. But you learn after a while how to make the coffee just right for my dad and other crew members. That's what I had to do to earn my stripes, you know, and that's what I'm expecting my nephews to do, to earn their stripes. Whaling is a dangerous business. You never know if that shoulder gun is going to explode in your hand. You never know whether there might be an accident involving the harpoonist and the rope. You know, it's easily could happen that you wrap your leg around that rope and you're going with the whale if you put the harpoon in the whale. So you got to be prepared for that. You got to have a long knife in front of the boat or an axe. And a knife on you. Because if you're underwater and you don't have a knife and the whale is dragging you around, what did you do? There's always a possibility you could cut the rope underwater. So you got to be prepared for every possibility. It's not an easy thing to do, even though it looks like it is, but in reality there's a lot of things involved in it.
I don't think it's going to change, and it hasn't changed very much, even with the impact of, you know, Western technology in the communities.
Marie Adams, Executive Director of the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission.
Whaling has maintained its own flow, its own motion. It's always been a cultural and traditional thing for the community, and I don't think they would want to change it very much at all. There's been some minor changes, which are basically just better ways of doing things, communicating through CBs, and that grants them a little bit more warning if there's, you know, ice breaking. Instead of being caught and moving eyes, they now can warn each other. You know, if it improves it that way, then they'll do that. But basically, because of the conditions on the ice, I don't think there's not much room for change. You need a boat that is lightweight, like the Umiak, and can take a lot of stress, like skin and the frame of the Umiak has been developed through centuries to meet the demands of hunting on the ocean. I don't think that's going to change. And they would continue to use, I think, handheld weapons are the best that they can. Under those conditions, that's not going to change.
Tom Brower's store is still a dealer for these guys, and they provide him with the harpoon, and they provide him with a darting gun, and they provide him with the shoulder guns. So we could get the equipment through Tom Brower's store, and I don't know where he gets them. That's not my concern, as long as he has them when it's whaling season, you know.
You're the only place in town that sells whaling equipment, is that right?
Well, I try to have whaling equipment. I don't know how the others are stacked.
Where do you get it from?
I've been getting it from back east.
Tom Brower Sr.
Not out of New Bedford, it's being made in Pennsylvania.
About how much, you know, does all that equipment cost for whaling these days?
Well, nowadays, a gun, a brass gun, will be about $1,000, $900 and some odd by time, with very little profit in it. I never try to make hardly any profit. Bombs have gone skyrocketed from $30 to nearly $50 per bomb. Then your darting gun will be about $600-$700. But your fine blades, for cutting blades, they don't ever manufacture them in the United States anymore. With the shaft, the beautiful shaft that you have to work in. And it could bend a little, but stiff enough so as to be workable to cut in through the blubber.
With the exception of the bombs, which must be replaced after use, the equipment lasts many seasons and is passed on from a whaling captain to a successor, often his son. Within the past 6 or 7 years, CB radios have become standard equipment as well. Each crew has a radio, as does the captain's home. The CB is on constantly during whaling season and monitored closely for news of whales and needs of the crews. Some people oppose the use of CBs, complaining that they weren't needed before and worrying that the noise might scare away the sensitive bowheads. But James Nariak feels the radios may become a powerful new tool that actually helps to reinforce some of the old ways.
If during the whaling season we say to the whaling captains in the community, okay, anybody that is out there, you're going to have to start talking in the language of your people. On the CB radios, they say, hey, you're talking English too much. Get out of that English stuff and go to Inupiaq. This is the whaling season. Even if it only happens for 2 months, you know. At least we know that the language is going to be spoken. Somebody's going to have to learn the language in order to be understood by the whaling captains or the whaling crews out there. Because we sometimes say, what are you saying? If they're speaking in English.
How about the whales themselves? What do they understand?
Oh, they understand our language for sure, because we've been associating with them for quite a while. And we know their habits. We know that they can be dangerous. We know that we have to have a good place to sleep. When we put them to sleep, you know, the cellar. There's that rapport with the whales, with the Eskimos.
Next on Chinook, the politics of whaling. I'm Karen Michelle McPherson. Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.